All right.
Yeah. No, it isn't all right. And it's not going to be all right until something major gets done about all of this that's going on, all right? I just got to tell you, sisters and brothers, this is no time to be sitting back and relaxing, all right? If you just listen to the news for 5 minutes today, you know what the hell's going on. And you know, there's just one thing I'm going to ask people. From now on, I don't want to hear nobody come up and tell me. I don't even want to hear anybody talking about this. Start talking about Trump and talking about this and that, and you know, the president, what he's doing. This is a Nazi. He's a fascist and he's a Nazi, and let's just call it out for what it is, and then people should act appropriately, all right? So that's what we need to get started with. And yeah, I've been screaming in my car. I've been yelling all the way over here. It is so infuriating to see what's happening here and to understand what it's going to mean for humanity if this is allowed to pass on, and what it's going to mean for humanity if people don't step up and stop this, all right? And at the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with Rachel Ida Buff, a professor of history and comparative ethnic studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And we're going to be talking about the terror created in immigrant communities from weeks of ICE raids, the need for creating sanctuaries, and the need for collective resistance. All right, so that's going to be at the back end of the show. Before that, we're going to be talking with Matt Adams, legal director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project in Seattle. And he's the lead counsel on one of the lawsuits that put a hold on the Muslim ban. The Muslim ban that was enacted by, and it was a... held up by and pushed by that Nazi, all right, that fascist that sits there in D.C., all right, or in Florida, as we were told so nicely this morning, and he's going to be talking about the impact of the ban and the fight against it. But opening the show up, I'm really, really glad to be doing this segment. We're going to be talking with someone I haven't talked to in quite some time. I remember the last time I spoke with him, I really enjoyed it, and I kept thinking, we got to get Peter back. Well, he's back. We're going to be talking with Peter Gleick, a leading scientist on global water and climate issues and co-founder of the Pacific Institute in Oakland. And he recently wrote about why scientists should be in the streets protesting the policies of the Trump regime, protesting the policies of the Nazi. OK, I'm just going to say it and deal with it. OK. And anyway, I'm really pleased to welcome Peter to the show. Peter, welcome back, man.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this, man. You wrote an article on Wired, Wired, and you talked about the uninhibited use of lies, false statements, blatant and intentional misrepresentation of fact, and bad science. And you gave as one of the examples, one of the most blatant examples is Scott Pruitt's denial of the role of greenhouse gases in climate change. And I'll tell you what, you can find that and you listen to this, what that Nazi just talked about this morning when they said, hey, the one thing we really definitely decided we're not going to fund at all is climate change because it's just a waste of money. So you had examples of all kinds of things that's wrong with that and why this question is so important. What are you seeing and why is it alarming?
Well, so, boy, there's so much there we could talk about. I'm a scientist by training. I work on global water issues. I work on climate change and have for 30 plus years. Science is sort of at my heart. I think without good science, you don't get good policy. And without a doubt, we're witnessing a war on science at the federal level. It's sort of unprecedented, the kinds of things that we're seeing, the denial of science, the promotion of, I don't even want to call them alternative facts because facts doesn't have anything to do with it, with the promotion of lies about the state of the world, attacks on the budgets of fundamental science activities at the federal level. It just, you know, goes on and on. I think your listeners probably know about all of this. And so I wrote this column. I'm a scientist, but I'm also I'm a citizen. And as your listeners may know, there are a couple of marches planned. There's a science march coming up on Earth Day, April 22nd. There's a climate march coming up a week later on the 29th. And I just felt, look, as a citizen, as someone who cares about fact and science in the use of in the creation of public policy, that I ought to be on the streets protesting what we see around us.
Mm-hmm. I have to go back to the thing that you started to talk about, facts and alternative facts, because like it or not, for all of us, this is actually an approach that actually is being enforced in society at large. I mean, you know, the slashing of education and everything else, but there's this whole point of facts and alternative facts that, and it has a bigger thing epistemologically. You really can never know anything with certainty. And to me, that's an extremely dangerous position that's being pushed out on people and that people actually, you know, take up spontaneously.
Yeah. So So first of all, I don't like the term alternative facts. Let's just call them lies. or not. You know, they're not facts. If either it's a fact or it isn't. And about this issue of certainty, you know, science is a funny thing. We all use science every day. You know, we use the products of science. We use the facts developed by science. Scientists talk about uncertainty. That's part of what we do, because part of science is understanding what we know, how well we know it, and what the role of what we call uncertainty is. But that's a funny term. And when a scientist says something is uncertain, the scientist means there's a range of possibilities. But when the public hears the word uncertain, they think, oh, look, you guys don't really know what you're talking about. And so we have to be careful as scientists in how we communicate what we know and what we don't know. And let's take climate change as an example. There's uncertainty about how fast climate's changing and about what the specifics of some of the impacts will be. But we know, we, the scientific community, know the climate's changing. And we know that humans are responsible. And so the deniers of climate change say, well, look, you don't know everything with perfect certainty, so we shouldn't be doing anything. That's a different message. And it's one that, you know, scientists take a little bit of blame for not being great communicators. But let me communicate. We know the climate's changing. We know that humans are responsible. And we know the consequences are going to be bad. What we choose to do about climate change is a policy question, and our politicians ought to address it, but they're not addressing it because they're pretending, they're hiding behind this, quote, uncertainty about the precision of what's going to happen when.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's another question I know you've spoken to before, but and this is something that I think is directly involved, or directly comes out of what you were just talking about, this whole idea, or this whole occurrence in these days of ideology trumping science. I think that's something that's really, really important in terms of, you know, people looking for, you know, looking for some way to fit things into their ideological view and not like looking at the world and reality and what needs to be done, but actually trying to shape that solely through, or trying to make things, everything flows from ideology. And it takes a top level over science itself.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So when I said earlier that you can't have good policy without good science. Look, there's plenty of times where good science is presented to policymakers and they consider it and they choose to make a policy that's different than what a scientist might prefer. That, you know, that's okay. That's the way politics works. But when you take bad science or you ignore science altogether to push an ideological point of view, then we're in deep trouble. And again, let's go back to climate change for a minute. Look, if Congress and our politicians were to say, okay, I understand that the climate's changing. I understand there's a critical human role here, but I don't think we ought to have a tax on carbon, or I don't think we ought to have a cap and trade policy to deal with it. That's okay. That's a political decision. And as a scientist, I would respect that debate. I might not agree with it, but I would respect it. But that's not the debate we're having. We're avoiding, at the political level, the debate about climate change because politicians are hiding behind the ideology of, I don't want government involved in this. I don't want to pay for the scientific research that's going to inform my decision making. And that's a very, very dangerous place to be.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, too, is, and a big part of that is actually also the creation of, you know, supposed science that actually would support this ideological position and threatening scientists who challenge any of that. You know, and I know you wrote about McCarthyism in science. I think it was, you know, this whole idea of that there's an element of McCarthyism in the witch hunts against scientists who don't go along with the program. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, that's right. So it's bad enough if we don't fund research that's critical to our well-being. It's bad enough if Congress doesn't even look at the science behind some of the things that they have to deal with. But it gets worse than that when you have, for example, the House Committee on Science and Technology, which is run by very anti-science ideologues at the moment, in my opinion, who are launching personal attacks on scientists and demanding emails and criticizing the individuals themselves rather than the science. That harkens back to McCarthyism. That harkens back to when Congress attacked people for ideological reasons rather than for factual reasons. Again, I think this is a throwback to days that we hoped were long gone, but that this administration has brought back to the fore.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Peter Gleick. And Peter is a leading scientist on global water and climate issues and a co-founder of the Pacific Institute in Oakland. And he recently wrote about why scientists should be in the streets protesting the policies of the Trump regime, both in the Climate March on April 29th and the March for Science on April 22nd, Earth Day. And we're talking today about the horrendous situation that exists under this regime and science, and how is science going to be actually impacted by all of this. You know, Peter, one of the things that comes out in this, in terms of this McCarthyism and the rest of this, is there really is, when you think about this, scientists really don't have, without the sort of the complete sort of openness to the ability to actually research and investigate things, there's not really a whole hell of a lot that can be done, you know, realistically. I mean, and it would make a difference. It would be real and true. And there is an element where people actually get pushed around and get told that they that their work should only be in this direction, or can only be here, and can only do this kind of thing. And so when you look about it, it's not just the threatening of in general, but there's actually real threats, and including, like you were saying, there's the question of funding, which brings to mind again, if you've listened to what Trump was doing with the budget and the way it was announced this morning, and you know, science is certainly getting slashed. You know, who needs that? You know, and it's sort of, there's all of these things that happen, and there's always been an importance to government-funded research. How big of a role does it play in science and in the ability of science to actually interact with the world and transform the world?
So one of the things that makes America great, frankly, is our unbelievably fantastic science. The university system, the federal labs, the research organizations that get some federal support, and frankly, I work for a nonprofit research institute. We get almost zero federal money, so that gives me a little bit of flexibility to speak my mind here without worrying about retribution. But that's not true for a lot of scientists that are very vulnerable to funding, that don't get credit if they weigh in on policy issues. That's a real problem. And let me give you some examples. You know, the federal research budget was just released a couple of days ago, and here are some numbers. So the NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Research Office, is facing more than a 50% cut in their budget. The EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency's R&D office, is facing a 50% cut in their budget. The Department of Energy programs are facing a 45% cut in their budget. The National Institute for Health is facing a 6 billion cut in their budget. They're talking about completely eliminating some of the satellite programs that provide weather forecasting. I could go on and on. The research budgets are proposed to be eviscerated at the federal level. Now, there are state budgets that support research. California is very fortunate in providing research money. There are nonprofit organizations that get money from foundations. So there's plenty of research that will continue to go on. But if we're going to cut our federal research budgets this badly, we're going to lose standing. We're going to lose information. We're going to close our eyes to threats that face us. You know, I don't know what Congress will ultimately do with this budget. Hopefully some of these budget cuts will be restored, but I think we're going to have to fight for research at the federal level.
Well, you know, it's very heavy because, you know, I mean, I think when I look at the situation with science in this country and under this system, I don't have as rosy an outlook as you do around the way science developed. I mean, I just think, and I'm not being facetious here, but it's just that, you know, the science is always, you think about what science has been. Yes, there's been a lot of people who fought to develop really great new things. And then all those things have actually been twisted and turned and used for, it's funny, who was the comedian that used to talk about this thing about, oh yeah, it was Jay Leno, when he was actually somebody you wanted to hear and listen to. And he talked about being the college kid that majored in chemistry in college and graduated and got his doctorate and then walked out and got a job. And he was all happy because he thought he was going to work for Dow Chemical. And, you know, and he said, but they said they changed. And they gave me this job and I can do all this. And he says, and then the first day you go into work and you're walking up to work and they say, hey, kid, you know, all that stuff we're going to let you do around, you know, curing all these diseases and developing this, put that on the back burner and work on this death gel for a while. Right? And that's actually a lot of what science has done.
So look, there's no doubt about that. There's plenty of science that's not done in the public interest, but federal funding for science is often done in the public interest. Mm-hmm. And if we lose that, there will still be corporate research, and not all corporate research is bad. Some of it's produced some incredibly great things, that had better not be the only research that is funded in the United States, or we're heading down a rabbit hole that we don't want to go down, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the questions I'd ask you is, you know, there's been, I don't know, man, I mean, it seems to me that I wanted to ask you this because it's sort of like when the pressure comes down on a scientist today, sometimes people are asked to actually produce bad science. They're sort of, your grant depends on finding the result. Your grant depends on who you're going to please, things like that. Is that something that happens on a regular basis now?
Well, so, you know, I guess there's some of that. I haven't had that experience because I've been fortunate enough to work in an independent organization. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you something else about the way science works. When someone publishes bad science, which happens, you know, science goes through peer review, but there's been a sort of an explosion of crappy journals now that'll publish anything. But when somebody publishes bad science, there's another scientist out there that will figure that out and will publish something that says, look, that doesn't make sense. That's not true. And bad science doesn't survive for long. You know, this stuff about vaccinations, for example, there was one paper published in England in a journal about how vaccinations were linked to autism. And that paper turned out to be bad science, and it was retracted by the journal eventually when other scientists stepped up and said, no, this doesn't make sense. All of the data shows the opposite. And that's what happens with science over time. You do get bad science, but other scientists ultimately will step up and say, wait, our results don't show that, and it doesn't survive for long.
Mm-hmm. Those sirens aren't coming for you, right?
No, I'm sorry. My office is
couldn't resist the joke. That's all.
Sorry, that's live radio. Right, I don't have a kid coming in the background.
There you go. Let's do this real quick because I wanted to get just one thing from you. And it seems like the bad news on the climate just keeps coming faster and faster. 2016 was the hottest year on record. The Arctic ice sheet is melting really fast. The coral reefs are all dying. Damn. Yeah. Give the listeners a brief update, if you could.
Okay, it's bad news. The climate is changing. Again, your listeners probably get this mostly, but the climate is changing. It is undeniable that the climate, not that it's not denied by some out there, but it's undeniable that the climate is changing. It is undeniable that humans are responsible. The science is very clear. And it's undeniable that the impacts are going to be very severe. This is agreed by every National Academy of Sciences on the planet and by every scientific organization on the planet. It's disputed by climate deniers who have their own agendas. But look around us. Look at the temperature records. Look at what's happening in the Arctic. Look at the rising oceans. Look at the horrible coral death that's happening in the Great Barrier Reef in Australia and elsewhere. We see it in Florida. Look at the changes in extreme events, floods and droughts around the world. The evidence is pretty clear. Now, we can ignore that evidence. We can do nothing about it. But what's happening on the planet is going to happen whether we deny it or not. And the longer we deny it and the longer we take action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the worse it's going to be for us and for our children and for our grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to end with this, Peter. There's a quote from you. It says, but when the time comes to speak, to stand up, those of us who can must do so. That time has come. And I'd say in triple. Okay. So.
So let me, can I just read the First Amendment of the Constitution to remind your listeners?
Peter, no, we are on a very tight schedule right now, man.
Okay. Go back to your listeners, go back and read the First Amendment. And that's why I'm going to be on the streets on the 22nd of April and the 29th of April.
All right, Peter Gleick, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right, talk to you again soon, man. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Peter Gleick, a leading scientist on global water and climate issues and the co-founder of the Pacific Institute in Oakland. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back to talk with Matt Adams, legal director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project in Seattle and lead counsel in one of the lawsuits that put a hold on the Muslim ban, on the impact of the ban and the fight against it.
Immigrant punk, immigrant, emigrada, emigra punk. Emigrant, emigrant, emigra punk. Emigrant, emigrant.
All right, welcome back. Yeah, we're moving really quick, all right? And that's Immigrant Punk from Go Go Bordello. And again, if you're listening and you've been awake at all and you know what's come down the pike and how quickly things are moving, it is really time, sisters and brothers, one, to think about what you need to do today, what you need to do from now on out, and what the kind of stand you need to take. And you got to look, you got to face up. Let's not be calling Trump Mr. Trump, President Trump, or calling him anything else but what he is. He is a Nazi and a fascist, and let's just call it out. Settle it up, and then let's get on to doing what needs to be done, all right? So let's, then we'll talk about that a little bit later as well. But I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Matt Adams, Legal Director of Northwest Immigrant Rights Project in Seattle and lead counsel on one of the lawsuits that put a hold on the Muslim ban. Matt, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah. So I see that you're still walking around. You haven't been jailed yet, right?
We're still kicking in and punching, doing what we can.
Good. Keep it up, man. Keep it up. This battle around what's become known as the Muslim ban has been extraordinary. When I'm thinking about it, when I was thinking about it this morning, in both the regime's dogged determination to push this through and the response of people standing up against that. Let's talk about that a little. Where do things stand now and the whole progress of this thing?
Yeah, so there has now been two different courts that have put a stay on the newest version of the executive order seeking to ban Muslims, seeking to ban individuals from the targeted six countries. Previously, the targeted seven countries, now the targeted six. But you have courts in Maryland, Hawaii, and here in Washington State that are addressing challenges to this newest version of the executive order.
But this is, now again, when you're talking about this, that, well, let's, here's an idea. Let's put a human face on it, because one of the things that people don't see often, especially when you're talking about these court cases, there's all this wrestling going on around these court cases, and there's the fight, and I think really important stuff, and lawyers like yourself standing up and actually pushing this and fighting for this and not folding in the face of what this regime is bringing down on people. But people oftentimes don't get enough of a sense of the human face on this. Give people a sense of who actually is being hit by this.
Sure. So let's talk about some of our plaintiffs. In the first round, we had Mr. Ahmed, who had gone to pick up his daughter, his 12-year-old daughter from Yemen, after she had already been approved at their consular interview. And of course, the consular interview didn't even take place in Yemen because the country is so dangerous. The U.S. had pulled out its tent and was no longer conducting interviews there. So they had to go to a third country and in Jordan have their interview, and it was approved. And then when they showed up at the airport to come to the United States, in between the approval and their making it to the airport, the first executive order had taken place. And so the officials at the airport had told Mr. Ahmed, well, you can get on the plane, but you need to leave your 12-year-old girl behind. And of course, that chaotic scene and that anguish of family separation was taking place not just abroad, but here in the airports, and as we saw. So with this second version, the administration tried to avoid the debacle of the first time, saying, well, people aren't going to be turned around at the airports. Those who already got those visas, they're going to be allowed to enter. It's just the new ones that are going to be put on hold. And so how does this affect people? Well, we don't have it in the spotlight at the airports, but we still have our plaintiffs who are affected. And so one of our plaintiffs is a mother of a 16-year-old boy in Syria. And so she's here desperate to be reunited with her boy. Her boy has already been kidnapped once and has faced threats on his life. And every single day that further extends the time period in which he can be reunited and come to live with his wife creates emotional and physical trauma for both him and the mother. You know, we have another client, Ms. Ali, whose 7-year-old child is stranded in Somalia with the grandmother, waiting to be reunited with her parents who live lawfully here in the United States. And again, every day in which the administration pushes back the ability for this family to be reunited, creates hardship. You know what's amazing in some of the briefs that the government says in their arguments at court is they try to minimize the harm, saying, you know, this is just a short suspension, a temporary suspension. There's no harm, real harm here. Well, you know, I have a 7-year-old daughter, and any government attorney who's telling me that a separation from my daughter is not irreparable harm. Well, I've got another thing to tell them. And the other thing, it's completely disingenuous for them to pretend this is just a 90-day hold. And there's a couple of ways I would point to. One is that in their first version, which happened over about a month and a half ago, they start out saying it was going to be a 90-day hold. And now with their second version of the executive order, more than a month later, they again say it's going to be a 90-day to hold. So I don't know what happened to those initial 35 days. But in addition, what happens at the end of the 90 days? Is that suspension automatically lifted? No, quite the contrary. What the executive order says is that suspension will only be lifted if these governments are able to jump through all these hoops. And of course, we don't even have diplomatic relationships with some of these governments. Some of these countries don't even have a government that controls all of their physical territory. And it's simply impossible for them to meet the conditions that are laid out in the executive order. And so how long this suspension will go on? Well, it's indefinite, and we don't know how much harm it's going to cause.
It's very heavy because people were thinking like, well, is there a significant difference between the first ban and the second ban? And it seems as people learn more and more about it, it is simply a polished version. The second ban is a polished version of the original. And that is it's a fairly heavy thing because when you talk about Trump's extraordinary assertions that he can ban people based on their nationality and all that has contains within it and what it portends in terms of what can be done, what's shaping up in the society, in the U.S.'s treatment of people around the world and people right here. Let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that we have going for us is the bravado of the Trump administration. They're openly bragging about all they've done with this new executive order is tweaked it to mollify the courts, but it's still going to result in the same policy. And so we're able to use their own statements. I mean, we had Giuliani bragging about how he was convened to create a commission to figure out how to legally implement this Muslim ban. And then you have the administration turning around saying, oh, no, this isn't a ban targeting Muslims. But we have their own words to throw back at them in the court. But I think what's remarkable about this is it shows just complete and utter disregard for our history. Because what is our history in the immigration context? Our history is one of explicit racism targeting countries because we wanted to keep to the minimum quota levels, the non-Western European immigrants coming into America. So the very first immigration laws, starting in the 1870s, were focused on barring Chinese and then focused on barring Asian immigrants from coming to the United States. And then later on, the national origins quota system was implemented. And so we had about 70 years, actually 80 years, of this explicit racism built into our immigration framework. And so finally in the 60s, when that was rejected, and was rejected in the same, you know, what's notable is not only did we get rid of this national origin quota system, but Congress implemented this non-discrimination clause saying, you know what, we've been through that, and it's not appropriate, and visas should not be issued based on someone's race, someone's sex, someone's national origin or country of birth. And so this, what the president is trying to do now, is directly spitting up against or just in complete disregard of our history rejecting this racist and discriminatory manner of issuing immigrant visas. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that's a little bit confusing is that there's within our immigration system, we talk about immigrant visas and non-immigrant visas. So immigrant visas are for the permanent visas, that whether that's through family visas or employment visas, but that's really the backbone of our immigration system. And that was the focus of the quota system, and that was the focus on who was going to be allowed to come and be part of our society and part of our democracy.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Matt Adams, legal director of the Northwest Immigrants' Rights Project in Seattle and lead counsel in one of the lawsuits that put a hold on Trump's Muslim ban. Now, you actually described this. You've argued that this government has no more authority to deny a visa to people from the 6 listed countries than it does to deny them entry for not being Caucasian. And when you put that together, with stepping outside of all the other stuff, the whole idea that it seems like a large part of what Trump and company are trying to do in their very fascistic manner is to whip up a whole hatred, a hatred for whole groupings of people, and intensely polarizing things as part of this.
That's absolutely correct. And at times I ask myself, I wonder whether Trump even cares if he wins in these legal battles that we're doing right now over the executive order, and whether really his agenda is just to throw some red meat to his anti-immigrant supporters and say, look at me, I'm out here fighting against these people that we're labeling as our enemies. And I think his supporters understand that, and certainly the immigrants in our society in the United States understand that they're being labeled as others. And that they have a president who is saying this society is for some but not for others. And he's dividing up the United States and saying these aren't united. Those are immigrants or those are Muslims. And that's having a dramatic impact not just on immigrants but on our communities. I mean, here in Seattle just last week, in the neighborhood right next to mine, the local synagogue was vandalized. And we're seeing this happening in unprecedented manner around the country, where you have synagogues and mosques and groups targeted. It's like the racists have come out of the woodwork because they've received the endorsement of our president and the actions that he is embracing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I was looking at something. There's a note I had I wanted to ask you about, you know, in terms of how revealing it is when you look at what's being cited by the Trump regime in terms of the need for this ban and the mysterious 300, right? Which, you know, it says I read something this morning that said, why does the Trump administration believe we need this order? And it quotes Sessions saying that national security is the driving force behind the ban and pointed to the cases of 300 people, he said, entered the United States as refugees who are now being investigated by the FBI as part of terrorism-related cases, yet he could provide no details. And then a senior Justice Department official earlier said cited the same statistic to reporters in a background call. The official refused repeated requests to provide any details about those cases, including the nationalities of the 300, or to say how long they've been in the United States. So it's interesting because there's also then the new order does not address concerns that were raised, interestingly enough, by Homeland Security intelligence analysts who said that it was revealed by the Associated Press that this thing concluded that there was insufficient evidence that citizens of the originally banned countries posed any terror threat at all to the U.S. and that the administration has played down the significance of that report. Let's talk about that a little in terms of what you've seen.
Yeah, I think it's just astounding, but it comports with how our president's behaved from the get-go and through his campaign, is that there's just no respect for facts, no respect for evidence, and instead they just throw out these assertions. So here they talked about 300 individuals who are refugees who are involved in some investigation to deal with national security. This is flawed on so many levels. One, they don't even say where these refugees come from. I mean, theoretically, every single one of those refugees could be from the Ukraine. We don't know where those refugees are from. And certainly there's no evidence provided that they're coming from the 6 targeted countries. And in fact, in a report in the Washington Post, there's someone who's out there, a source saying that it looks like if any country, you know, the majority of them are not from the 6 countries, that there were a group from Iraq, but of course Iraq is no longer on that list. But moreover, what does it even mean that you're one of 300 people that are on this list? You know, I have clients who are requested interviews by the FBI, and they get put, their cases get put on hold because the FBI flags them as of a person of interest in their national security investigation. And it's not because of anything my clients have done. Sometimes it's because they're investigating an uncle. Sometimes it's because they want our clients to be their snitches, to go and start participating in meetings and mosques that our clients don't even belong to, so that they can then funnel information to the FBI. And if our clients are afraid or for whatever reason don't want to play that role, then our clients' cases gets put on hold. We're filing a separate lawsuit where they've placed many naturalization and applications for permanent residence on hold under another vetting program for people who are already living here in the United States. And just with this lawsuit, just like many others before, as soon as we filed the lawsuit, they immediately turned around and granted the citizenship application of our named plaintiff in order to moot out the case. I mean, certainly if our plaintiff were a threat, then why did they immediately turn around and grant his case within days of us filing the case? So the fact that someone is on this list of investigations means absolutely nothing. And, you know, I think just as telling is a different piece of supposed evidence that they pointed to in their executive order. And that is they talked about one Somali who had been convicted for terrorism charges. Well, you know, that Somali came to the United States as a refugee when he was 5 years old. He's been living here since he was five. And so if he has developed any affinity or if he is part of a terrorist organization, that's because he became a terrorist here in our community. The United States turned him into a terrorist. It wasn't because we messed up in our screening and accidentally admitted a terrorist into the country. Mm-hmm. So I think the evidence they point to is anything but evidence. I think it's a demonstration of their blatant disregard of the need for evidence to support this in the name of national security.
And as well, the whole point about whipping up this other part of their agenda in terms of mobilizing this fascistic base that Trump has pulled together and unleashed in a huge way right now and actually really focusing a lot of attention on immigrants. And, you know, that's part of the whole program. Now, Matt, I wanted to ask you one thing. Can you give people just real quick, we only have about a minute and a half left, but can you give people a sense of where do things stand in relation to all this right now?
Sure. So right now with the executive order, the second version of the executive order that's being challenged, it's been placed on hold indefinitely. The judge in Maryland issued a preliminary injunction, and the judge in Hawaii issued a temporary restraining order. We have other challenge here in Seattle where the judge issued an order enjoining the first version of the executive order. The next step is, of course, for the government to appeal those orders to the courts of appeal or to try to move forward in district court and submit more evidence to try to support the actions that they say are required to be taken in order to secure the United States. But given that the evidence is non-existent to support what it is they're trying to do. I mean, the bottom line is they're trying to assert that courts shouldn't even be in a position of asking for evidence, that the actions they're taking are not subject to judicial review or judicial oversight. And in essence, they're asserting that when it comes to national security, the president is king, and there is no one who can question what he's doing when he makes a declaration about who should be admitted. And so whether that proceeds in district courts or now goes back up to the courts of appeal, we're going to see.
Mm-hmm. All right, Matt Adams, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll stay in touch, man.
Okay, my pleasure.
All right, take care. You're listening to The Mike Slate Show, The Michael Slate Show, The Mike Slate Show? What am I doing here? You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Matt Adams, legal director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project in Seattle and lead counsel in one of the lawsuits that put a hold on Trump's Muslim ban. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Emigrada, emigraniada, emigrada, emigraniada, da, emigrada, emigraniada. We're coming rougher every time.
We're coming rougher, we're coming rougher.
We're coming rougher every time.
Hey, 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 hey.
We're coming rougher every time.
That's right, we gotta come rougher every time. Rougher and rougher, and it's gonna get rougher and rougher, and we gotta be tougher and tougher, all right? Because this is hell that we're looking at right now, all right? Just the other day, I came upon a person who was writing and doing things that really grabbed my attention. Her name is Rachel Ida Buff, and she's a professor of history and comparative ethnic studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And she's been writing on the terror created in immigrant communities from weeks of ICE raids, the need for creating sanctuaries, and the need for collective resistance. She's also got a new book coming out soon called Against the Deportation Terror, Organizing for Immigrant Rights in the 20th Century. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. It's good to talk with you. Well, let's jump into things right away. All right. I'm actually, as I'm saying that, I'm looking for where I did with all the, oh, there it is. Okay. See, I've got a desk full of paper here. Right? Okay. Your assessment of the situation facing immigrants today. Give people a picture of what's out there and the impact it's having on immigrants and their families. This is an extremely important thing, I think, in terms of people actually understanding this is a group of people who very often are kept in the shadows, either you know, the real shadows or, and increasingly so, the real shadows, but also the shadows of people's living on the edges of what people see, you know, and the people see them every day, but they know nothing about them. So give people an assessment of the situation facing immigrants today.
Yeah, I think that's a really good phrase. Thank you for saying that. Living in the shadows. So I think what we have is people who are already marginalized because of being undocumented. And it's important to say that there are 12 million estimated undocumented people living in this country. They don't live en masse. Like, so most undocumented people live in households with people who are citizens and people who are legal permanent residents. So it's not like there's a clump of people in the shadows. It's that there are people whose lives are partially shadowed. So in the state where I live, in Wisconsin, there's no legal driver's license for undocumented people. That came about in 2005 with the passage of the Real ID Act. So that means, and we don't have very good public transportation here, even in a city like Milwaukee, where I live. So that means if you're driving to the work you can obtain as an undocumented person and you get stopped for a traffic seizure, that's a cause for fear in the best of times, even before the current regime. What we've seen in the past 4 weeks since the executive order about immigration is an upsurge of terror in these communities, because there were a lot of deportations under Obama, but the general gist, and it wasn't always observed, was to try and deport people who were criminals or who had outstanding warrants. What we've seen now is almost the opposite, the criminalization of being undocumented. So what we've seen is an upending of everyday life. So if you are going about your everyday life, if you are dropping off your child at school, if you are headed to work, if you're on the bus, if you have to go to the courthouse, God forbid, for any particular reason, all of those places become spaces of terror. And we've seen deportation raids from hospitals, from schools, from all the places that constitute everyone's daily life. The other important thing that should be said is that in 2011, in the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, there was a so-called sensitive locations memo that said, you know, it's really not good for the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agents to perpetrate raids in schools and hospitals and churches. This administration so far seems to be pursuing a very different direction, and that has a lot of consequences. I was recently visiting Western Michigan, and I was teaching a class, and I asked the students in the class, you know, what do you know about what's going on? And they talked about people they knew, undocumented people they knew, selling their cars and moving out of apartments and houses so that they would maximize the number of adults home in case one of them got deported and the kids came home from school without a parent there, about people preparing to leave to so-called self-deport, about people selling off their possessions. So I think what we have, and it's unclear yet whether the 3 to 4 million promised deportations will take place, what is already taking place is a level of terror in everyday life for many of the people in our communities.
Now, you've said that, and I think it's extremely important. You've also said that news of the assaults on immigrants, it's really important that actually people know that people actually get this out, that news of the assaults spread throughout the communities themselves, but then also beyond those communities. Let's talk about the importance of that.
Yeah, I want to say that I'm involved with a group of other immigration historians that we're doing a project called Documenting Deportation, because I can go into the historical reasons for this, but starting around 1954 with Operation Wetback, one accomplishment of the then Immigration Service, now the Department of Homeland Security, was to broadcast the fact that there were these illegal aliens, so-called, in our countries, while at the same time completely disappearing their names. So that in the press, we just hear about this mass and they almost don't seem human, right? So you hear about illegal aliens detained and they sound like a bug or something. Instead of, it's really important, and it's because of 80 years of the immigrant rights movement, people saying, no, you know, this person has a name, this person is somebody to me. And so right now, the way things are going, only the government has the names of people in deportation proceedings. It's very difficult, for example, if somebody is detained, if you're a family member or friend is detained by the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, they're often taken, it's such a lucrative business, the business of detention, right? So you could be taken from Milwaukee County, detained in Illinois and wind up in detention in Texas, and your family would have very little ways of figuring out where you are. So it's a technique of power, and it's a technique of power for immigrant rights advocates to be able to track this information, you know, to be able to say this person was detained, and to, you know, it's been an achievement to say, you know, these are people, they have names. One thing that happens in my community is every first Thursday of every month, the New Sanctuary Movement has a vigil in front of the Immigration Customs Enforcement Detention Center in town, and they read the names of the people in deportation. And it's really powerful. It's, you know, even before the current administration, it would be a really long list. And it's really powerful to hear the names, because otherwise, I always ask audience, how many people do you know? The names of how many people do you know who have been deported? And except for Latinos, people don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, other migrants, immigrants. If you're not in an immigrant community, you tend not to know the names of anybody, so they don't seem like people to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very important. I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Rachel Ida Buff, professor of history and comparative ethnic studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and we're talking about the terror created in immigrant communities from weeks of ICE raids, the need for creating sanctuaries, and the need for collective resistance. You've been deeply involved in the sanctuary movement. Tell people what that is.
The sanctuary movement, the current incarnation of it, looks back to the 1980s, when mostly religious communities gave sanctuary. And this is an older tradition, right, that the church is a safe space. It goes back to the Bible. It goes back to the Middle Ages, that churches and temples and mosques are safe spaces, and they can shelter somebody from being apprehended. So that happened during the dirty wars in Central America, which the U.S. was deeply involved in militarily and in shipping aid through military advisors and through training people at the School of the Americas. And it generated waves of migrants, right, because they were fleeing terror that we had sponsored in their countries. This is really important. So when we have Honduran children walking to our borders and they seem to just turn up here, they're fleeing terror that the United States created in their region. That's really important. And I think people don't often connect the dots. Anyway, so that was a mostly religious-based movement in the 1980s. And in about 10, 15 years ago, there was a new sanctuary movement that said, you know, we're going to give aid to people who are in these situations, people, you know, from Central America, from Mexico, from Africa, from Poland, from Ireland, who are undocumented and who are in fear of or dealing with deportation. What we've seen with the current administration, and, you know, there's a whole complicated relationship and a really important relationship between the new sanctuary movement and movements like the Dream, the Dreamers, the young people advocating against deportation and for legal status for themselves and their communities. But since the inauguration, we've seen a lot of communities really asking, you know, are we going, you know, really thinking, you know, is there, what churches are there that have kitchens and cots and bathrooms, and how many people can they shelter? And I see this all over the country, that people are asking, like, you know, can we shelter people? How can we shelter people? How can we prepare for this? And I also think a lot of communities, like traditionally this has been in foreign-born communities, but I think that one thing that's happening is, as we contend with what you were just talking about with the Muslim ban, as we contend with rising incidences of hate crimes against LGBT communities and communities of color and Jewish communities, like that, we have to think broadly about how can we have public security? What does security mean for all of us? Right? So I think that there's a lot of renewed thinking going into sanctuary as securing public safety for all of us. You know, what does it mean if we live in communities where a good portion of us are terrorized and afraid to go, literally afraid to go out, literally afraid to go about their day-to-day lives? And that's going to be more and more of us, right? How do we go about addressing that and creating a space of safety?
Mm-hmm. Now, you've argued that this, you know, and actually you've made the point very clearly and very powerfully that this sanctuary movement does exist in some tension with federal authorities and federal law.
Yes.
And are there reprisals? What are the kinds of reprisals that people should know about?
Well, there's a lot of political threats. You know, we're in a season of political bullying, right? So in Wisconsin and federally, there are these anti-sanctuary city bills that have been proposed. It's certainly something that's been promised by our current presidential administration. Sheriff Dave Clark, it's very interesting in Milwaukee because the county of Milwaukee, our county sheriff is Sheriff Dave Clark, who's very anti-immigrant, very anti-Black Lives Matter. He's literally, he wears a cowboy hat and cowboy boots everywhere. And he claims that sanctuary cities are, quote, breeding grounds for crime because they're places that shelter undocumented people. And because, and this is an important grammar, because undocumented people, by virtue of being here, are considered by people like Dave Clark criminals. That's the only kind of criminals they are, it should be pointed out. He makes it sound like we're like talking about free space for rapists and murderers. That's not what anyone is talking about. So we have that. But our county in early February passed an anti-discrimination resolution that included instructing local police not to comply with federal immigration enforcement. So this sets up a pretty interesting tension because there are promised reprisals at the state level, at the federal level. And of course, we have this very anti-immigrant sheriff. But what I call popular morality, which is that most people do not want to see their neighbors dragged away from their children. Most people see, if they can see it, if they're allowed to see it. And one really important thing is that these have been made invisible, so we don't have to witness them. But when we witness them, they're appalling. And most people, you know, the churches that have granted sanctuary and have been involved in the sanctuary movement aren't radical churches. They often tend to be sort of liberal mainline Protestant churches or Catholic churches or Reformed Jewish temples or mosques, where people say, you know, this is a very basic moral issue of giving shelter to the stranger, right? It's not that radical of a position. So we're really in a place where, like we are with so many things in the current moment, where we have to say, you know, where are we going to stand in terms of basic human decency? And how are we going to have a politics that allows that in this regime that intends to brutalize people, that states its intent to brutalize people? And I don't think we really know. I mean, there's a constitutional issue here as well. Can the federal government force states, force campuses, force counties to comply? I don't think that's been litigated yet. And, as we've seen with the Muslim bans, there are constitutional reasons those don't work. I'm not sure a federal anti-sanctuary bill, a federal bill that mandates that local police departments have to sign 287G agreements and enforce immigration, I'm not sure that's constitutionally enforceable.
Mm-hmm. All right, Rachel, as unbelievable as it seems, we are going to have to wrap this up right now. So I wanted to, we'll have to have you back, and especially when your book comes out. When's it coming out?
I think it should be early fall, but I'll definitely let you know.
Yeah, definitely do. And we'll stay in touch in terms of the development of these things, because I'm sure as hell, I'm confident that things are good with Trump and Pence and everything that's going on with this. This is a regime that actually is, it's a regime that has in its vision the entire sanctuary movement and all of the people who depend on that in terms of being able to stay free and alive. All right. So we'll definitely be in touch.
So we have our work cut out for us, but I'll definitely send you a copy and we'll be in touch.
Great. All right, Rachel, take care now.
Thanks so much.
Sure. Bye now. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Rachel Ida Buff, professor of history and comparative ethnic studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, on the terror created in immigrant communities from weeks of ICE raids, the need for creating sanctuaries, and the need for collective resistance. All right. And I want to run something out here, something that I've been thinking about for quite some time now, and it's really important. All right. There's a growing struggle of thousands, and this became even more important as I'm driving over here and I'm listening to the budget and all the talk about this and what's going on and the giant face of fascism just glowering at you, And there's a growing struggle of thousands of people standing with immigrants and against the persecution, raids, and deportations. That resistance is just and it must grow. And the sanctuary movement must be supported and strengthened, both because the stakes of this battle for tens of millions and because right now it is a key front in the battle to resist and drive out the Trump-Pence fascist regime. If sanctuary jurisdictions are destroyed or crippled, life will get far, far worse for immigrants. It will have a horrible impact on society as a whole. It simply cannot go down. It is a terrible thing, but it's a key piece of the whole vision and mission of the Trump-Pence fascist regime: demonization, persecution, and driving immigrants out of the U.S., at least ones who don't fit into their definition of white, and is central and essential to their hellish agenda to make America white again. For them, there is no turning back in the war on immigrants. They have whipped up mobs of people who believe they are entitled to going back, way back, to a nightmarish era of U.S. history and worse. That requires the violent ethnic cleansing of America. The battle to defend immigrants in sanctuary jurisdiction is a life and death battle in its own right. And there are even bigger stakes. All of this has the potential to become a flashpoint in society, eruptions of conflict that could prove pivotal to whether or not the Trump-Pence fascist regime can fully consolidate. Attacks on immigrants and sanctuary jurisdictions specifically must be resisted. We must have a movement that says no to the whole thing, that demands the immediate ouster of this vicious and extraordinarily dangerous fascist regime. The stance embodied in the slogan, "In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America." And if you want to get involved, you can contact Refuse Fascism. Their website is refusefascism.org. You can reach them on Facebook, and their Twitter is @refusefascism. And if you want to send an email, their address is info@refusefascism.org. And their phone number is 917-407-1286. Once again, that's 917-407-1286. And if you go to the Refuse Fascism website, you can find a chapter in your area. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another show. And I want to thank our guest, Peter Gleick of the Pacific Institute, talking about the March for Science, Matt Adams, legal director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, and Rachel Ida Buff of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. You can find all of them on social media. I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Kiana Williams. And I want to thank each and every one of you for listening. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, and just before we go out, I want to make sure that people know that there is a brand new video on revcom.us. Yep, that's once again revcom.us. And the video is a teach-in by Andy Z, who is one of the co-initiators of Refuse Fascism. And the title of the video is "What is Fascism? What it means for humanity that the Trump-Pence regime is fascist, and why it must be driven out." So once again, check that out on revcom.us. We're going to go out now with "I Can't Take It No More" from John Fogerty. Talk to you again next week.